Welcome. Inside Appalachia, I'm Jessica Lilly. This week, we're looking at some state foods. There was outrage in West Virginia recently about a food we hold dear.
Well, I know it started way back with the coal miners. They got a piece, a loaf of bread and a stick of pepperoni and ate them together because they couldn't spoil when they was in the mines.
In North Carolina, we'll hear about another Appalachian favorite with a long history.
And they used to joke, you know, that the judge would smell the barbecue smoke, you know, was wafting up, and he would recess for lunch, you know, so everybody would come down and eat at the barbecue.
You'll find these stories and more this week Inside Appalachia. Welcome. Inside Appalachia, I'm Jessica Lilly. Have you ever heard of a pepperoni roll? Traditional pepperoni rolls have these long sticks of pepperoni baked into a soft golden roll of slightly sweet dough. When you bite into them, you can see two pieces of pepperoni cut pretty thick, about as big as a pencil. The grease bakes into the white Italian bread and the rolls get a nice light brown crust on the outside. Oh man, I'd love to have a great big pepperoni roll right now. This show's going to make me hungry, but worth it. Okay, where was I? Oh yeah. Okay, they're usually larger than a dinner roll, about the size of a hoagie, although that depends a bit on who's baking them. One guy who bakes them is Dennis Mazza. He owns the Rogers and Mazza Bakery.
It's a culture of West Virginia. I mean, like I tell people, you know, Pennsylvania has the Philly cheesesteak, Chicago-style pizza, you know, Illinois. West Virginia has our pepperoni rolls.
Pepperoni rolls have been called the unofficial food of West Virginia. They were invented here in the Mountain State, and legend has it they were originally made for coal miners to take underground because the cured pepperoni didn't spoil. A traditional pepperoni roll doesn't have any cheese or sauce. But some residents of the Mountain State prefer to have their own unique twist on the recipe. Marge Jarrett sells pepperoni rolls at the Country Club Bakery in Fairmont, West Virginia. Over the years, she's perfected her technique for reheating them at home.
And do them under the broiler. Yep, cut them in half and do it. Put butter on them. That's the favorite way for me. A lot of people like the pepper sauce and cheese on them.
But that's not the only way to eat a pepperoni roll. We asked some of our colleagues at West Virginia Public Broadcasting about the pepperoni rolls in their lives.
And I guess my first experience with a pepperoni roll was probably in 94 in the back of a Winnebago driving from Charleston to Morgantown for a WVU Pitt game. And we were all throwing down on chili, and someone had this strange see-through bag with these little rolls in it, and I dipped it in the chili thinking it was bread, and lo and behold, it had a surprise inside, a little bit of pepperoni.
They're kind of the perfect treat because they're filling, but they're yummy and everything else.
One of my former employees let me know that on any road trip in West Virginia, you have to stop at a Go-Mart and get a bag of pepperoni rolls. Doesn't matter if you're going for 10 minutes or 2 hours, you have to have that bag of pepperoni rolls. And the plainer the bag, the better the pepperoni roll. It looks, if they spent little money packaging it, that's probably the best pepperoni roll you'll have.
I've loved pepperoni rolls for a while. I used to eat them during high school. That was the only lunch that I ate at high school because I knew they were going to be so good. And it was always on a Friday. Those were pepperoni roll days.
I just eat them out of the bag, really. And I found, personally, I think the stick, pepperoni stick rolls are better than the rounds that they put them because the sticks seem to have more flavor to them. Have to have some sort of cheese in it. You don't want it being too dry, not too much sauce.
Typically, I'll take a bite. It depends on how big they are. If they're big enough, usually I'll rip them in half at the center, always at the center. And then I'll take a bite out of one, whichever one has the pepperoni roll, the pepperonis exposed, and then I'll eat it, and then I'll eat the other one. If it's a small pepperoni roll, I'll pretty much just eat that in like one or two bites if I'm, you know, really in the mood.
And I think the way I like to eat them is warm them up if you can or have them fresh out of the oven and sort of tear them apart and eat the inside first and then the outside.
As of late, I've found actually an establishment outside of St. Albans. Grumpy's Waterfront Grill has an appetizer, pepperoni roll appetizer, and they come 8 to a plate. They're about as big as your fist and loaded down with mozzarella cheese and pepperoni. And there's a nice sampling of marinara sauce in the middle to dip in. They're crispy on the outside, soft and doughy on the inside. They are just awesome. And if you sit down by yourself, they're not an appetizer. They're a main course.
Sometimes I do marinara sauce. Not very much. If it comes with marinara sauce, I'll eat it with it just to be polite. But the beauty of pepperoni rolls is that you don't have to do anything else with it. It already has the pepperoni, it already has the roll. It's heaven in a bun.
And it's kind of fun when I take things to places in other states. I always try and bring them some West Virginia pepperoni rolls.
That's Kate Fitzgerald along with Chuck Roberts and Joni Deutsch sharing their thoughts about West Virginia's unofficial state food. The pepperoni roll was in the news lately after a convenience store chain called Sheetz announced they would stock a single brand of pepperoni rolls from out of state instead of sourcing them from smaller West Virginia bakeries.
Well, I put it on Facebook, and in no way ever did I ever tell anybody to boycott Sheetz.
Dennis Mazza's bakery, Rogers and Mazza, is one of the bakeries that's been selling pepperoni rolls to Sheetz.
I just informed, you know, my Facebook that we were no longer going to sell pepperoni sheets as of August the 3rd. It went viral. I mean, it wasn't just about our bakery. It was about every bakery. It was about the pepperoni roll in general.
Rogers and Mazza wasn't the only bakery that was notified that they'd no longer be doing business with Sheetz. Home Industry Bakery and Abrazino's were also dumped by the convenience store chain. But then, on Facebook and Twitter, angry customers called for a boycott of Sheetz. They wrote things like, "Sorry, Sheetz, but I'm going elsewhere. Being Italian, I love my friends and family just as much as I love pepperoni. And love your stores, but right is right."
You know what? We knew that it was a passionate item.
Ryan Sheetz is a spokesperson for his family's Pennsylvania-based business.
So we knew that we would get some feedback. I don't think anybody could have anticipated the level of feedback that we got.
It seems that Sheetz had opened a nest of bees when they announced that they'd no longer source from local West Virginia businesses. It hit a nerve because, after all, pepperoni rolls are a heritage food that plenty of West Virginians grew up with. Some West Virginians just don't think pepperoni rolls baked in other states are the real thing. In fact, the very idea that a warehouse in Pennsylvania would even attempt to undermine West Virginia's unofficial state food, that was something that many West Virginians simply could not accept. So then, Sheetz reversed its decision. The company will look for a West Virginia supplier who can make enough for them to buy from just that one bakery, but only for its West Virginia stores. They still don't know who that will be. Dennis Mazza says if his bakery loses the Sheetz contract, they might have to lay off a few employees.
You know, it just hurts, you know. I mean, it hurts everybody. And now you're just sitting here doing the waiting game, you know, just waiting to find out what the next move is by Sheetz.
Employees are worried. Richard Lee Smith is a delivery truck driver for Rogers and Mazza.
You know, when you get a big cutback, it hurts. It hurts everybody, just not management, but down to the last person that was hired.
Richard has a theory about why so many people throughout West Virginia were outraged with Sheetz's decision.
I think it's like everything else. I think it's like it still comes back from the old days that people actually do care about each other. If you think about, you know, people used to share their gardens, their products. They used to get together and have, you know, just like they do now. It's except on a broader scale, they have festivals and stuff. And I think, you know, people used to go to church and they used to have picnics and stuff. And I think that when it comes down to the nitty gritty or tough times, that the people in West Virginia we're brothers and sisters. We stand beside each other.
Richard delivers pepperoni rolls down to gas stations and little convenience stores in the southern West Virginia coal fields, a place that's really hurting right now because of widespread layoffs in the coal industry. He says folks in those communities where he delivers pepperoni rolls have been talking a lot about the Sheetz incident. A lot of them see this as a small battle in the midst of so much else that they just can't control.
And I think people overall are getting kind of fed up with the big man stepping on the little guy, and he's the one that's keeping him in business. I mean, it's not always the guy that's out here doing the biggest thing. It might be the guy that's doing the smallest thing that makes the business.
Some of what Richard Smith says about pepperoni rolls being much a part of family gatherings and communities helping each other out really rings true to me. See, I never grew up eating store-bought pepperoni rolls. I remember them from school lunches, and in my community of Mullins, We'd even sell pepperoni rolls to raise money for sports teams and field trips.
Start spreading the news.
My one and only trip up to New York City was funded in part by pepperoni rolls that I sold. They were made by a lunch lady at her school. I know people who say lunch ladies make the best pepperoni rolls in West Virginia, but others say that unless you get them from one of the original, authentic Italian bakeries, they're not really the real thing. For that, many people claim you have to travel to the birthplace of the pepperoni roll, to Fairmont or Clarksburg in north central West Virginia. Here, Italians and Hungarian, Greek, and Polish immigrants, just to name a few, all came to work in the coal mines in the early 1900s. Back then, throughout Marion and Harrison County, these were multicultural boom towns, and pepperoni rolls were born from the Italian coal mining community that sprouted here.
Corn, bread, and butter, beans, and you across the table. Eating beans and making love as long as I am able. Oh, and corn and cotton too.
That story leads us to another one of our occasional segments, Appetite Appalachia. Our producer, Roxy Todd, traveled to the self-proclaimed birthplace of pepperoni rolls, Fairmont, to tour the Country Club Bakery and to talk to customers who were waiting in line to buy fresh pepperoni rolls hot out of the oven.
Even before you walk through the front door, the smells are pretty enticing. Fresh pepperoni baked into white Italian bread, mixed with the sweetness of fresh chocolate cookies, all cooling on the racks. That's what greets you as you walk inside. A big glass counter full of pepperoni rolls fills the room.
Who do you see come in to get pepperoni rolls?
All different types of people from all different states.
That's Marge Jarrett behind the counter.
I just had people just left here that never had them before come back in and got more.
Beside Marge, pepperoni rolls are on display behind glass. Behind that are shelves of cookies, all fresh out of the oven. On the wall are framed newspaper clippings that tell history of the first pepperoni rolls, which date back to the late 20s or early 30s. The first owner of this bakery supposedly invented them and sold them to coal miners.
Miners took bread and pepperoni, and then they'd bite pepperoni, take a bite of bread, and so he decided to do pepperoni rolls.
Pat Carr and his brother Larry walk in the door. Pat still lives here in Fairmont, but Larry is visiting from California, and he just had to make a stop on his way to the airport to buy 2 dozen pepperoni rolls.
Looking forward to getting these home and put some sauce and cheese on them and throw them in the oven, and they'll be perfect. It's the only place you can get them is right here, and these are the best.
Larry remembers smelling these pepperoni rolls baking even from the road.
Every time you drive by here, you could smell them, and that just drew you right into the parking lot. I remember that as a child, driving by here. The windows were open, and you could smell the fresh pepperoni buns coming out of the oven.
His brother Pat says the simple, Spartan look to this bakery is part of its charm.
When Larry and I were a kid came here, and I was just telling Larry when we got out of the car, I said, it looks exactly the same, but it's well kept. It's a neat place.
But the most important thing about pepperoni rolls, according to the Carr brothers, is this. Again, here's Larry.
I mean, there are several people that make pepperoni rolls, but most of them don't use the sticks like you use here. They use slices of pepperoni, and I think the sticks are much better.
Most of the pepperoni rolls that are sold at gas stations and in supermarkets, those all pretty much use round, flat slices of pepperoni. So the thing with the whole sheets brouhaha doesn't even faze customers like Pat and Larry, because they prefer to buy fresh pepperoni rolls straight from the bakery. The doors of the Country Club Bakery seem to revolve with a constant flow of pepperoni roll customers. Janet Living grew up in nearby Ida May, one of the former coal camps in Marion County.
I've been eating them for like probably 60-some years, and so I love them. This bakery's been here for a lot of years, and it's very special.
The dough for the pepperoni rolls was all mixed early this morning and set to rise. The head baker, Misty Whiteman, begins the process at 2 o'clock in the morning.
I eat them, not a lot, but when they smell really good coming out of the oven, yes, they do starve me to death.
But Misty's favorite way to eat the pepperoni rolls?
I like them with a garden tomato on them and Miracle Whip. Yeah.
Misty doesn't look like someone who's been stuffing herself with pepperoni rolls. She's small but strong. She's been working here for 34 years, and she insists on doing all the heavy lifting of the flour sacks herself.
Well, you get used to it after a while. You do it every day, every day, every day, every day, yes. Yeah, they always say, you ought to get them boys to do it. And I said, nope, them boys ain't here. Who's going to do it? So, and if I'm not built up to do it, then I can't do it. You don't get bored. Right now, and it's very, very busy with the heat and the humidity. You're lucky that you get to turn around and sit down maybe 5 minutes.
Back near the ovens, it is very hot. Misty's used to it, but I'm sweating.
This is where we bake the pepperoni buns in this oven here. The pepperoni buns and buns, and over there's the bread, cookies, pies. It's in that one.
And when the pepperoni rolls are baking at 500 degrees, Misty says it probably gets well over 100 degrees in this room. She doesn't know exactly because the thermometers max out at 105 degrees. The Country Club Bakery is very small. It feels like a real kitchen in somebody's home. Someone comes in every day to cut the pepperoni by hand, and the machine they use overlooks a green lawn. Light from the huge windows shines everywhere. Misty agrees with the customers we heard from earlier. She doesn't like those pepperoni rolls that come from convenience stores because they don't even compare to one of these warm pepperoni rolls right out of the oven.
Very good, yeah, way different. They're a lot better, fresh.
Misty is one of about 10 employees here. Together, they bake about 300 dozen pepperoni rolls a day, all right here in this one oven.
Isn't that awesome? Yeah. I can get 20 pans in that oven, 45 dozen.
And like when pepperoni rolls were first invented, they're often eaten as a meal unto themselves by lots of people here in West Virginia.
And then when the summertime, when it's real hot, everybody gets pepperoni buns because you don't have to cook them. They're all done. Make a sandwich. I mean, it's a good meal.
Although it certainly isn't the most nutritious meal, it is filling for a long stretch of time. And because the pepperoni is already cured, it doesn't spoil like another type of meat. That's something that U.S. Senators Jay Rockefeller and Robert C. Byrd had to explain back in the 1980s when the USDA was trying to reclassify these mostly small, family-owned bakeries as meat packers. Rockefeller and Byrd argued that this change in designation would require bakeries like Country Club to meet the more stringent safety and sanitation standards that meat processing businesses have to follow.
I remember that.
What was it like?
It was a real war.
It was a war?
Well, you know what, it was not a war, but it was just weird. Because we would joke around about having our little pepperonis out in the yard. Because they wouldn't make us into a slaughterhouse. And actually, we're not. So anyhow, we talked about going out there, killing our little pepperonis, and it was funny.
But the USDA heard the concerns by Senator Rockefeller and Senator Byrd, and they agreed to allow pepperoni roll bakeries to continue to exist without reclassifying them or forcing them to undergo daily inspection.
It did work out because we're still able to make pepperoni buns, and we don't have to be labeled as a slaughterhouse. Yeah.
Pepperoni rolls came to the attention of lawmakers again 2 years ago. A bill to declare pepperoni rolls as the state food was introduced in the state house. It was late in the session, and the bill went to the Rules Committee, where it died. But pepperoni rolls are still the unofficial food of West Virginia for many people. They're so important that one bakery set up a satellite shop where West Virginians go on vacation to make sure they wouldn't have to live without pepperoni rolls while they were away from home. D'Annunzio's second bakery is just outside Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. So far, no one has written a history of the pepperoni roll. It's not even clear where it was invented. Tomorrow's is the oldest Italian bakery in West Virginia. It opened in 1914. But the owners don't dispute Country Club's claim to have invented the pepperoni roll.
You know, I do remember growing up, my father and Cheech from Country Club were, you know, good friends.
Marisa Brunette and her brother and mother still own their family's business. Marisa says last year, when Tomorrow's had their 100-year celebration, they baked 6 extra-large pepperoni rolls, each 7 feet long. They haven't checked with Guinness yet, but they're pretty sure that Tomorrow's holds the record for the largest pepperoni roll ever made.
For Inside Appalachia, I'm Roxy Todd.
Looking for a rewind button? Don't worry. Inside Appalachia is available as a podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, and wvpublic.org. You can subscribe and listen on your own time. This is Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. We'll be right back.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
Thanks for tuning in. You're one of a growing number of fans of Inside Appalachia. Thank you for telling your friends, and thank you for subscribing to our podcast. We're talking about signature foods this week. So far, we've heard about the baked goodness that is the West Virginia pepperoni roll. But it isn't the only food that's made its mark in West Virginia. This next story, we pulled from the Inside Appalachia archives to find out more about a food that sprouts up across Appalachia. As a matter of fact, festivals celebrate this food in Virginia, Tennessee, North Carolina, Kentucky, South Carolina, Pennsylvania, Ohio, and even New York and Canada. But the town of Richwood, West Virginia, claims to be the birthplace of the festivals to celebrate the Ramp. We hear once again from Roxy Todd, who visited the Ramp Festival in Richwood in 2014.
The air is saturated with the smell of ramps, a pungent, garlicky, peppery smell, so strong that it eclipses almost everything in the room. There's also an aroma of bacon. The ramps have been fried in bacon grease and are served with brown beans and ham. A local songwriter, John Wyatt, is playing his Richwood ramp song for the hundreds of people waiting in line for their meal.
And the ramps begin to grow in the mountains. Then you'll know that it's springtime again.
Ramps are the first wild foods that appear in the forest each spring. The yearly tradition of eating ramps symbolizes the renewal, hope, and vigor of spring. The festival also marks a return for many Richwood natives. Dana Johnson moved to Alabama, but he comes home for the festival each spring to make sure he gets his dose of ramps.
They are considered a spring tonic. They're good for you.
Many people, like Johnson, have left Richwood to find jobs or open new businesses out of state. Since 1980, the town has lost more than 40% of its population. And a third of the remaining 2,000 or so residents are living in poverty. The ramp feed is one of the few moments in the year when this depressed small town feels like a thriving community. Out-of-towners also come to the festival, like Carrie Comiskey from East Hampton, Connecticut.
This is my first time tasting ramps and my first time to the Ramp Festival, and I plan to come back every year.
With her tanned face, Comiskey is in hiking boots as she sits with her husband and their two friends at a local restaurant. She lists the purchases that she's made at the festival: a handmade wooden table and a wooden coffee grinder. And fresh ramps, of course. She bought these from the Four Seasons Outfitters store, located along the two-lane highway into town. The owner, Bruce Donaldson, is also the largest ramp seller in Richwood. He ships about 20,000 pounds of ramps each year to buyers all over the U.S.
My men, the men that work for me, are basically laid off in the wintertime. A lot of them's in the logging industry. A lot of them transfers to coal fields, and they'll work a month. They'll be laid off. Sometimes they'll have to go 100 miles to find another job.
Like to buy some ramps?
People are camped out by the side of the road, hawking ramps that they've harvested. 11-year-old Tyler McCune is out with his stepfather and his uncles, selling the wild leeks for $4 a pound. He wears faded jeans and a navy blue t-shirt, and his blue eyes squint in the sun.
He taught me how to dig ramps. My uncle, he taught me, and my grandpa, my stepdad.
Tyler's grandfather and stepdad used to work in the sawmills. His grandfather is now disabled, and his stepdad's out of work. But they still dig ramps each spring as a family. Some people here worry that ramps are being over-harvested, and there's a debate over how much of a threat that is. Tyler McCune says his grandfather taught him how to harvest the right way, without being, as he calls it, an overpicker.
Overpickers? Yeah, they like dig every ramp they see. See, you can't do that here. I mean, you can dig a lot of ramps, but you can at least leave some roots behind. That way they'll grow. We'll be able to keep having this good ramp feed up here in Richwood. Everybody enjoys. I enjoy it.
At the end of the one-day festival, organizers estimate the crowds have consumed about 1,700 pounds of wild ramps. The local Chamber of Commerce has raised about $3,000 to $4,000. The money will help the city remove a few of the abandoned, derelict buildings and add more art and historic photos to the vacant storefronts in downtown Richwood.
That was our producer Roxy Todd reporting on the Ramp Festival in Richwood, West Virginia, back in 2014. Coming up, we'll hear about the state food in North Carolina. But first, it's time for What's in a Name? So today on our show, we've been talking about a few of the signature foods that are pretty widely celebrated by many people here in Appalachia. But chances are you've never even seen the Appalachian food we're going to talk about next. For this week's What's in a Name, who knows the name of a town that was named after a fruit that can be found along the rivers all across Appalachia and is often the perfect snack for hikers? It's kind of a secret outside of this region. Here's a hint. Folks in Ohio celebrate this fruit each year at a festival dedicated to this Appalachian food. They even brew it in beer. But the town we're talking about this week is not in Ohio. Where is it? We'll have the answer after the break. This is Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly with the answer to this week's What's in a Name quest. While Ohio might be known for its state nut, the Buckeye, a festival in Albany, Ohio celebrates the pawpaw. But what state has a town named pawpaw? For the answer, last fall we chatted with Susan Moreland. Moreland works in a local school in Pawpaw, West Virginia. She says the town gets its name from the fruit that tastes something like a cross between a banana, a peach, and a mango.
The Indians named this area Pawpaw after the fruit. And it's a fruit kind of like a pear, a little bitter. Actually, out here on the school lawn, there's a couple pawpaw trees, and right now is the best time. They're in season. So help yourself to some.
We originally spoke with Susan back last fall, and in just a few weeks, pawpaws will be in season. So if you know where to find a pawpaw tree in the forest, or if you can travel to the Ohio Pawpaw Festival in September, the 11th through the 13th in Albany, Ohio, you might be one of the lucky few who has tried a wild pawpaw. You can share your stories about pawpaw, be it the fruit, the town, or your grandfather. Just send us a tweet at InAppalachia. Our show today is focusing on signature foods from Appalachia. And like I said earlier, many folks haven't heard of the pawpaw fruit because it's kind of an Appalachian secret. But as NPR's Allison Aubrey discovered back in 2011, more and more people outside of the region are discovering this secret too.
There's nothing more delicious than a secret, right? So you'll understand why I wanted to get my hands on this fruit called a pawpaw, even if it means bushwhacking through a muddy riverbank.
This is fun. This is the hunt.
Matt Cohen is my guide. He's a professional forager, and he knows where the pawpaws grow.
And it looks like there's plenty of them still growing along the banks of the Potomac here. It's just a matter of finding the fruit, is that right?
Oh, yeah.
So you're pretty sure that there's a patch right up here ahead?
Yeah, there should be one right up here ahead.
Now, this is the American pawpaw, completely different from a papaya. And Cohen is a big fan. As we hike along, he's trying to catch a whiff of its distinctive scent, which he says is fruity, almost floral. He uses his nose to guide us.
Okay, I'm feeling like we got to be getting close, huh?
Oh, yeah. We're getting close to another patch.
He looks way up through the dappled light dancing around the branches, and he spots them. On a high branch, we see what looks like three little mangoes hanging in a cluster.
So this is a pawpaw, huh?
That's it, yeah.
And when we shake one down from the tree and slice it open to taste it?
What do you think?
Wow. It really does taste like a mango, but a little more perfumey, like maybe a little melon in there.
Very tropical, huh? Kind of has a custardy texture. It's really surprising.
Now, if you go way back, people knew all about the pawpaw. Thomas Jefferson had them at Monticello. And when he was minister to France, he even had pawpaw seeds sent to his friends there to show off something impressive that grew in his new country. But pawpaws were never grown commercially, which is why you don't see them in grocery stores.
80 out of 10, $1.20 will be your change.
There are hints that this could change. In the last 5 years, a few commercial orchards have been planted, and farmers markets from Maryland to Ohio have begun to introduce the fruit.
We have some people who have been asking us for weeks, when does the season start? When are we going to start having pawpaws?
That's farmer Kelly McBride Gill. She's been selling pawpaws for a couple of years now. At first, her customers who come from suburban D.C. had only one question. What the heck is a pawpaw? She had to convince them to try one. But this year?
Yeah, we had one box come down with my father, who comes down early, and he had to call us at 8 a.m. being like, we need more. Bring down the other two boxes, because people get so excited that when they see it, there's no hesitation.
None of this would ever have come to pass if it hadn't been for a man by the name of Neil Peterson. He's a plant scientist, and about 35 years ago, he had a eureka moment. He took his first bite of a wild pawpaw.
It was just a revelation because they were really fine pawpaws.
Peterson thought this pawpaw was every bit the rival of a perfect peach or apple, and these fruits have had thousands of years of breeding to make them taste good.
And the pawpaw out in the woods is just like this without any breeding.
And the thought that came next was the beginning of his lifelong obsession. Maybe he could breed a commercial pawpaw.
I could just make that instantly, that leap of imagination.
It's taken him 3 decades, but those pawpaws that the customers at the farmer's market were so excited about, well, these are Neil Peterson's babies.
This is going to be quite a treat.
At the Olney farm market, pawpaw newbie Joan Foster said she's been waiting a long time to try one. They're only available a few weeks out of the year.
Very good. Wonderful flavor. On my tongue, it says this is something new and wonderful and that I should continue it.
And the pawpaw may be more than just a fruit that tastes good. A few food scientists think they may have a super fruit in their hands.
Well, with respect to the pawpaw, we're at the early stages of the research.
Rob Brannon is a food science professor at Ohio University, and he's been excited about the pawpaw ever since he did a study to evaluate the number of antioxidants in the fruit. He found it's pretty high.
It's about the same as a cranberry. It's about the same as a cherry.
And that's not a bad start, he says. If scientists could put a health halo over the pawpaw, well, Brannon thinks it could give the fruit a commercial boost. It's happened before. Take the case of the pomegranate. A generation ago, the pomegranate was just a specialty item, but not now.
There was an individual who decided that they were going to buy farms in California and grow pomegranates. And they spent upwards of $15 to $30 million to fund research that showed the benefits of the pomegranate.
Clearly, the pawpaw doesn't have much health research behind it, at least not yet, nor does it have a patron. But it does have something that people are looking for. It's local, it's sustainable, and Brannon says people like the idea of eating a fruit that doesn't have to be flown in from halfway around the world. Plus, he says it has a fascinating history.
There's the story that when Lewis and Clark were working their way across the United States, they survived on the pawpaw. So, promoting it as this all-American crop, Native American fruit. It's a tropical fruit, but it grows here in our temperate climate. These types of things make it very, very interesting.
Now, for a fruit to be a commercial success, it needs certain qualities. And here, well, the pawpaw needs some work. For instance, it doesn't ship well because it's pretty fragile. And it's got big seeds, which people don't like. And the season is very short. But at a pawpaw festival earlier this month in Ohio, people were showing off at least one way of extending the pawpaw season. They make pulp from the fruit that can be canned and frozen, and even use it to make beer. Garen Wright of the Buckeye Brewing Company in Cleveland wasn't convinced the taste of the pawpaw would come through in his brew. But it did.
I really think that I got freshness out of that pulp that you can really smell and taste in the beer I made. So it's awesome.
This has become an annual festival. 6,000 people turned out this year to celebrate the pawpaw. There were tastings, baking demonstrations, and a huge cook-off moderated by Michelle Wasserman.
second place for pawpaw mango salsa.
And there were lots of local vendors, too.
Pawpaw smoothies, pawpaw guacamole.
Chris Schmiel is the festival organizer, and he says the biggest hit?
Yeah, there's like the pawpaw ice cream is incredible.
The fresh pawpaw season is about over for this year, but you may still be able to find some ice cream or sorbet. Some adventurous chefs are beginning to play around with the pawpaw, and they say people do seem eager to give America's own homegrown mango a try. Allison Aubrey, NPR News.
That story first aired in fall 2011 on NPR's Morning Edition. The pawpaw season is coming up this September, so there's still time to try the wild fruit this season. Let's head south to North Carolina to talk about barbecue. The city that calls itself the barbecue capital of the world, Lexington, North Carolina, got a little surprise when a construction crew got a physical reminder of just how ingrained barbecue is in the city and state. WFAE's Sarah Delia went to Lexington to hear more about this particular find and what it says about the city's past and present relationship with the food they're best known for.
This story about barbecue actually starts in a city hall annex building. It was in need of an overhaul. Construction started, they checked the wiring and pulled back walls. And that's when city manager Alan Carson found something unexpected.
I walked in one Saturday looking at the renovation. I came in one Saturday and I was like, holy mackerel, look what we have here. So I called a friend of mine, a fellow by the name of Cecil Conrad. I said, I think I know what I'm looking at, but I'm really not sure. So he came up and he said, Alan, those are barbecue pits. And I was like, okay, so that kind of kicked everything off.
These pits once belonged to a local barbecue legend, Alton Beck. From 1949 to 1979, this building was home to Beck's Barbecue. The pits look like a long brick hallway. You can see where the wood would have been placed and burned below, and where the pork shoulders would have been stacked above.
Yeah, we could have taken this down in a hurry and really, really been sad about it.
Back in the 40s and 50s, Beck's Barbecue was one of the places to be. The smell of cooking pork hung in the air from open to close. Charles Steamy remembers it well growing up in Lexington.
I remember it in its heyday, and it, you know, it's nostalgia for that. It's been a long time.
Steamy is part of another Lexington barbecue dynasty. He ran the restaurant his father started, called Steamy's. His son runs the business today in Greensboro. Standing outside the former restaurant turned municipal building, he says barbecue and local government have always had a connection on this particular street. We're currently on West Center Street. He points to the street next to us, Greensboro. Part of that road is known as Barbecue Alley. By the 1920s, barbecue pitmasters cooked beneath tents and sold barbecue sandwiches to people who came to do business at the courthouse across the street. The area around the courthouse was unofficially known as Lawyer's Row because, well, that's where all the lawyers were. This location was key. It made barbecue a destination. It became Lexington's signature food.
The court day, it was sort of like a festival, and they used to joke, you know, that the judge would smell the barbecue smoke, you know, was wafting up, and he would recess for lunch, you know, so everybody would come down and eat at the barbecue.
It was also an easy way to start a business, especially during the Great Depression, Steamy says.
You could do a pretty nice business without, you know, a lot of trouble getting into business.
He describes the barbecue business back then as a humble one. With no refrigeration, they were motivated to sell as much as they could in a day.
So really, it was just something that they figured out that, you know, they could do to make a living. The real question is, I guess, is why didn't it happen everywhere?
Steamy says to those families that made up Lexington's barbecue infrastructure, it was this hard work that made them value the food. Because as cheesy as it sounds, barbecue gave back to the people of Lexington, financially. And now, these years later, it's the city's main attraction. Lexington, with a population of about 20,000, swells to around 200,000 during its annual barbecue festival, according to the city's website. After the discovery of the barbecue pits, it wasn't a question of if they were going to keep them. It was, let's find a way to have our office space and barbecue history, too. Again, city manager Alan Carson.
It was one that, you know, we knew right away we were going to have to work to restore and keep. So we weren't going to have just a wall. We were going to have to do something with the pits in order to, you know, keep that heritage and that history in place. That's our responsibility.
So the city is working with architects to preserve the pits and that history and move forward with redesigning the office space. That's good news for barbecue historian John Shelton Reed. He and his wife, Dale, are the authors of Holy Smoke, the big book of North Carolina barbecue. Today, he sees more of a push for uniformity across the state, kind of like an international house of pancakes, but for barbecue.
It was an intensely local thing. I mean, you drive 100 miles, barbecue changes, you know, cooking different cuts of pork, or you're not cooking pork at all, you're using a different sauce. You know, you can tell where you are by what the barbecue looks and tastes like. But increasingly, we're going back to uniformity, this time presumably with thick red sweet sauces that lie on the surface like icing.
To Reed, barbecue isn't just about the food. It's about the businesses generated from the food, the sense of community it provided for those who cooked it and those who ate. It's about the pit masters who were up before the sun each day cooking over sweltering pits, places like a restaurant simply called Lexington Barbecue. Ricky Monk's father opened Lexington Barbecue in 1962. Ricky's been working here for over 40 years, and his son works at the restaurant too. So do two of his sisters, a brother-in-law, some cousins, nieces, nephews. His mom does bookkeeping. His dad, Wayne, is still involved.
We have three kitchens. This is our kitchen where everything goes through here.
Ricky wastes no time whisking me back through a crowded kitchen to the main thing I came to see, the pits, functioning ones, that cook meat as we speak. The kitchen is hot, and there's no AC. Ricky says the pit stayed at about 275 degrees. Turkey legs and pork shoulders are cooking, and the smell of meat, hickory smoke, along with the sweet, tangy vinegar sauce fill the air. When he opens the door to one of the pits, that smell hits you like a brick wall.
These have been cooking since roughly about 6 o'clock this morning. Don't let that door come back on. On this here, there's, what, 33 or 34 shoulders, 36 shoulders on there.
Using the pits, Ricky says, isn't always easy. There's a hot spot in the fire you have to find every day. It's sweaty, hot work. But he says it's the right way, the Lexington-style way to cook, which is why he's grateful the city is saving the pits in the municipal building.
It's just good for our heritage. I hope we can work something out so people, the public, can see what we're doing with it. They can showcase it off here and there. My dad's working on some, I reckon you're going to call memoirs.
When Ricky Monk talks about barbecue, he inevitably ends up talking about family. For him, the discovery of the pits in Beck's Barbecue and the city's plan to showcase them is like a memorial to the local families that built their lives on barbecue. As far as Ricky is concerned, it's the foundation Lexington is built on, and it's not going away anytime soon. For WFAE News, I'm Sarah D'Elia in Lexington.
Speaking of barbecue, we wanted to share this essay with you. Jason Sheehan is a food critic from Denver. He believes barbecue unites us, comforts us, and is the only thing he can't get enough of. In 2006, Sheehan heard about the NPR special series called This I Believe on his car radio. The series invited listeners to share their beliefs that guide their daily lives. Here is Jason Sheehan with his essay for This I Believe.
After listening to the results of this project for several weeks, I knew I could do 3 minutes too. Certainly not on world peace, or the search for meaning in an increasingly distracted world, or anything as grave and serious as all that, but on a belief just as true. I believe in barbecue, as soul food and comfort food and health food, as a cuisine of both solace and celebration. When I'm feeling good, I want barbecue, and when I'm feeling bad, I just want barbecue more. I believe in barbecue in all its regional derivations, in its ethnic translations, in forms that range from white tablecloth presentations of cunningly sauced costillas, to Chinese takeout spare ribs that stain your fingers red, to the most authentic product of the tar paper rib shacks of the Deep South. I believe that like sunshine and great sex, no day is bad that has barbecue in it. I believe in the art of generations of pitmen working in relative obscurity to keep alive the craft of slow smoking as it's been practiced for as long as there's been fire. A barbecue cook must have an intimate understanding of his work, the physics of fire and convection, the hard science of meat and heat and smoke, and then forget it all to achieve a sort of gut-level zen instinct for the process. I believe that barbecue drives culture, not the other way around. Some of the first blows struck for equality and civil rights in the Deep South were made not in the courtrooms or schools or on buses, but in the barbecue shacks. There were dining rooms, backyards, and roadhouse juke joints in the South that were integrated long before any other public places. I believe that good barbecue requires no decor, and that the best barbecue exists despite its trappings. Paper plates are okay in a barbecue joint, and paper napkins, and plastic silverware, and I believe that any place with a menu longer than can fit on a single page, or better yet, just a chalkboard, is coming dangerously close to putting on airs. I believe that good barbecue needs sides the way good blues need rhythm, and that there is only one rule. Serve whatever you like, but whatever you serve, make it fresh. Have someone's mama in the back doing the taters and the hush puppies and the sweet tea, because mama will know what she's doing, or at least know better than some assembly line worker bagging up powdered mashed potatoes by the ton. I believe that proper barbecue ought to come in significant portions. Skinny people can eat barbecue, and do, but the kitchen should cook for a fat man who hasn't eaten since breakfast. My leftovers should last for days. I believe that if you don't get sauce under your nails when you're eating, you're doing it wrong. I believe that if you don't ruin your shirt, you're not trying hard enough. I believe, I know, there is no such thing as too much barbecue. Good, bad, or in between, old-fashioned pit-smoked or high-tech and modern, it doesn't matter. Existing without gimmickry, without the infernal swindles and capering of so much of contemporary cuisine, barbecue is truth. It is history and home, and the only thing I don't believe is that I'll ever get enough.
That was Jason Sheehan with his essay for the podcast and radio series, This I Believe. Sheehan first recorded that essay back in May 2006 for the NPR special series called This I Believe. The series invited listeners to share beliefs that guide their daily lives. The series had a 4-year run on NPR and is still available with new episodes as a podcast. You can find those on iTunes. Just search for This I Believe. Thanks for listening to this week's show. And now, I'm off to have that pepperoni roll. Just one now. Only one. We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from WFAE in Charlotte, North Carolina, NPR, and the podcast This I Believe. Music in today's show was also provided by Andy Agnew Jr., Jake Sheps, and the Glenville State Bluegrass Band. Our producer is Roxy Todd. Catherine Winter edited our show. Special thanks to our first intern for the show, Jade Arthur Holtz. This was Jade's last week working with us. Jade's studying journalism at WVU. We wish her well. We'd love to hear from you. You can email us at feedback@wvpublic.org. Find us on Twitter @InAppalachia or @JessicaYLilly. You can also address your letters to Inside Appalachia in care of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301. The Inside Appalachia podcast is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and at wvpublic.org. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a news and public affairs production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.